reading of the declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by studying otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. All 24 lodges worldwide are united by the principles contained in the Declaration, yet each is independent and determines how frequently it will meet to disseminate these ideas. In Philadelphia, there are two weekly meetings, a Sunday morning lecture from 11 until 12. Doors to the building open at 10:30, and a Wednesday evening study class. An umbrella topic is selected, and various aspects of it get discussed throughout the month. In October, the theme was Theosophy and the Theosophical Movement. Volunteers discussed theosophical goal as being universal brotherhood, that the masters or Mahatmas are real, and have preserved theosophy throughout time, that by whatever name called, the ancient religion, wisdom religion, or theosophy, the principles remain the same, and that the principles of theosophy can be used as powerful guides to help us walk our talk on a daily basis as we strive for universal brotherhood. For the month of November, the topic is reincarnation and karma. Volunteers have so far discussed that karma is not linear. It could be operating in this life, in the process of being made or stayed for the future, or it could be held over from the past and not operating yet. Also, mention was made of the suggestive evidence for reincarnation as noted in the research by the late Dr. Stevenson at the University of Virginia, where those interviewed were able to describe previous existences in other families. And last week's talk was on reincarnation and karma as the doctrine of hope and responsibility, and that what we sow is what we reap. Thus, we are invited to sow theosophic principles that will help us better help others and uplift humanity. Today's talk, the teaching of the Stoic Epictetus, concludes the talks on reincarnation and karma. Next month's umbrella topic will be cycles and psychic law. And next Sunday's talk is psychic influences on humanity and individuals. The Wednesday evening study class meets from 7:30 until 8:30. We are presently studying The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge, We have studied the masters or Mahatmas as perfected human beings, evolution of the cosmos and of the earth, and are presently studying the human constitution, which we will continue to study for the rest of the year. We have finished chapter 4 and will begin chapter 5 this Wednesday. We also have a reference library which is open on Wednesday evenings from 5:15 to 7:15. It closes 15 minutes prior to the start of the study class and is available for those who wish to browse to see where their intuition leads them, for those who wish to study the nice assignment, and for those doing independent research. We also have a small bookstore, a book table of sorts, which is open before and after meetings for the purchase of straight line theosophical materials, which consists predominantly of the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, also Robert Crosby, and those whose writings are consistent with theirs. The materials may be purchased at cost, as no profit is made on the sale of the wisdom religion. The materials may be also downloaded by us accessing the website for the United Lodge, Phoenix, Arizona. Also, these talks are recorded and can be heard on podcast by accessing the Philadelphia ULT website. Volunteers are a key factor in all that is done at the lodge. They give her their time, resources, and energies to ensure that the wisdom religion continues to be available and disseminated to those who want it. For those interested in being a volunteer, please speak with the person at the books table. Now for a reading from Epictetus's writings, which will be followed by today's lecture. From the Discourses of Epictetus. Have you not received greatness of soul? And why do I trouble myself about anything that can happen if I possess greatness of soul? What shall distract my mind or disturb me or appear painful? Shall I not use the power for the purposes for which I received it, and shall I grieve and lament over what happens? Yes, but my nose runs. For what purpose then have you hands? Is it not that you may wipe your nose? How much better it is to wipe your nose than to find fault. What do you think that Hercules would have been if there had not been such a lion and hydra, and stag and boar and certain unjust and bestial men? And what would he have been doing if there had been nothing of the kind? Is it not plain that he would have wrapped himself up and slept? The lecture today is the teachings of the Stoic Epictetus.
The student who was supposed to give this talk is unable to because of illness. And as it was a particularly favored and loved aspect of the philosophy and history of this student, it is indeed our pleasure and privilege to be able to present it instead. And to note that except for a few comments, the text or the body of this presentation is directly from the student's notes. So we have been looking at this month the teachings of karma and reincarnation. In a pamphlet by Mr. Judge called Aphorisms on Karma, we read that there is no karma unless there is a being to make it and to receive its effects. And we also learn from the study of various devotional books from different traditions But the basis of action, which is karma, when it comes to a human being, is the mind. In fact, there is no progress in any area of human evolution unless it is through willful, self-induced, and self-devised efforts, because we are mind beings. And in terms of our moral responsibility, that which we reap we shall sow, there is no moral responsibility for a human being until that mind, that spiritual faculty of thought, will, determination, enters into and makes contact with the developing human form. And this is said to occur around the age of 7. So it is clear that from a point of view of karma, how we use our thinking principle, our mind, is a very important part of applying this theosophical principle of theosophy in our everyday lives. So it is quite fitting today that we talk about Stoicism, particularly the teachings of Epictetus. And since the Stoics and Stoicism was a prominent philosophy ranging from about 300 BC to about 150 AD, we might ask, well, that's very interesting from a historical point of view, but why should we study it today? And we might simply state that Stoicism has sort of had a rebirth in our modern times, although it was primarily a philosophical approach to life. It has re-expressed itself in our modern times in a particular kind of psychological therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy, which is one of the most successful therapies to ever been developed in the 20th and 21st century for the treatment of psychological disorders. As a matter of fact, the founder of cognitive behavioral therapy, a psychologist by the name of Albert Ellis, was directly inspired by the teachings of the Stoic Epictetus. And Dr. Ellis wrote, "People don't just get upset, they contribute to their upsetness." And it is echoing a very old saying by Epictetus, "Man is not disturbed by things, but by the views he takes of them." And of course, even here in Philadelphia, Dr. Aaron Beck in the 1960s went on to perfect the system of cognitive behavioral therapy, which has its foundations on a philosophical understanding of life thousands of years old. So we'll begin with, what is a Stoic? Now, even in discussing this subject today, it occurred to us that most people think of Stoic as kind of a personality trait. You think a Stoic face, one that doesn't show any emotion or upset in the face of difficulties. And so they might be perceived as unemotional because they don't seem to wear it on their sleeve or show it easily on their face. They keep a Stoic face. But Stoics are misperceived as unemotional. This is a classic misconception because they try not to act out of their emotions. They seek to be indifferent to things they don't control. A Stoic feels emotions like any other human being, but they refuse to be enslaved by them. Stoics act in a rational manner despite their emotions. So what is the meaning of the word Stoic? Stoa is actually a Greek word for porch. The teachings originally were freely given outside on a porch to anyone who wanted to hear them, to the high, the low, the wealthy, the poor. When did it begin? Zeno, a Phoenician merchant, founded the Stoic school in Athens around 330 BC. And originally his teachings were known as Zenoism. But because they met on a painted porch, it became known as Stoicism. And for nearly five centuries, it was one of the most influential and highly regarded schools of philosophy practiced by the rich and poor, by the high and the low. And as we said, it has a timeless appeal because even today its basic principles, as we will see, are the basis of cognitive behavioral therapy. So we're speaking here today of the teachings of Epictetus, one of the more prominent and contemporarily recognized teachers of Stoicism. Epictetus is not his proper name. The word or the name Epictetus actually means slave and servant, and he was a slave. We don't actually know his real name, but he was born a slave in 55 AD at Hierapolis, a Greek city of Asia Minor, and spent a portion of his life in a wealthy household as the slave of Epaphroditus, an important administrator in the court of Nero. His owner recognized a high intelligence in him and gave him permission to pursue liberal studies, and that is how Epictetus discovered philosophy. Through the Stoic Musonius Rufus, who was his teacher and mentor, he became quite enamored with and instructed and impressed with this philosophy of Stoicism. And so impressed was his owner by his wisdom that he actually granted Epictetus his freedom from slavery when he was a teenager. So Epictetus lived in Rome until his banishment, when he went to Nicopolis in northwestern Greece for the rest of his life. And he taught there and had many disciples, hundreds of disciples, and continued to influence from that center, even emperors in this philosophy. He finally passed away in 135 AD. Now, who were some of the main Stoics that we recognize? Because there are actually many of them, and we have a partial list available if anyone is interested. But one of the earlier Stoics was Seneca, a well-known Roman senator and playwright, and Seneca was the tutor to the Emperor Nero. His letters, Seneca's letters, actually survive and are a great source of what the actual Stoic philosophy was. Besides Epictetus, probably the one other Stoic who is most famous to us and we have the most information was the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, who was the Roman Emperor from 161 to 180 AD. He was given a copy of Epictetus's discourses and thanked his mentor for that in his own book called The Meditations. And even as the modern day practitioner of cognitive behavioral therapy will encourage their patients to do. He sat down each day and each evening to reflect on the day and write down in his private diary what he observed of his thoughts and feelings and how they affected his life. This private diary has been published as the book Meditations, and it's the most significant source of Stoic philosophy. It is a wonderful source of practical wisdom. Epictetus taught many of Rome's greatest minds, one of which, as we mentioned, was Marcus Aurelius. His teachings were written down by one of his students, Arrian, called Discourses and Enchiridion. As a side note, Enchiridion often gets translated as handbook, but it literally means ready at hand, more like a sword than a handbook, always ready to deal with life's challenges. Reminds us of that statement in the Bhagavad Gita, he who cuts away all doubt with the sword of spiritual knowledge. That is what this little book of Epictetus did, allowed the practitioner to look up whatever they needed to do to cut away their doubts and deal with the problems of life. We think that to gain an appreciation for how Epictetus was such a great teacher, it is only necessary to begin with the discourses. Book 1, chapter 1 begins the title, Of the Things Which Are in Our Power and Not in Our Power. And he goes on to say, of all the faculties, you will find not one which is capable of contemplating itself, and consequently, not capable either of approving or disapproving. How far does knowledge of the grammatical art possess the contemplating power? Only as far as forming a judgment about what is written and spoken. And how far does knowledge of music go? Only as far as judging about melody. Does either of them then contemplate itself? By no means. But when you must write something to your friend, grammar will tell you what words you must write. But whether you should write or not, grammar will not tell you. And so it is with music, as to musical sounds. But whether you should sing at the present time and play on the lute or do neither, music will not tell you. What faculty then will tell you? That faculty which contemplates both itself and all other things. And what is this faculty? The rational faculty, mind. For this is the only faculty that we have received which can examine itself, what it is, what power it has, and what is the value of this gift, and examines all other faculties. For what else is there which tells us that golden things are beautiful? For they do not say so themselves. Evidently, it is the faculty which is capable of judging of appearances. What else judges of music, grammar, and other faculties, proves their uses and points out of the occasions for using them? Nothing else. And so we see, even from the very beginning of his discourses, he's making the point that the mind is the most important faculty that we have for examining our behavior and determining how we will act. And so he's teaching karma, or action and reaction, without using that word, from a very practical point of view. And we have a few other quotes that express that in the language he does, but not with the same Sanskrit word. But we did want to give you a few more quotes from the Enchiridion by Epictetus for us to think about, carry with us, meditate on. The condition and characteristic of an instructed person, or one who is wise in the teachings of Stoicism, is this. He expects all advantages and all harm from his mind and not from his environment. He doesn't blame his parents. He doesn't blame his environment or his heredity. He seeks for the causes of his suffering and his salvation in himself, particularly in his own mind. And reminds us of the teachings of the Buddha, who taught the same thing. Ye suffer not, but from yourselves. And from the moral point of view, this can be applied as well. He censures and criticizes no man. He praises nor flatters no man. He blames no man. He accuses no man. He says nothing about himself as if he were somebody or knew something. In other words, he maintains a certain humility, realizing that our ultimate power is not on the particular virtues we have able to show or the particular achievements. Our ultimate judgment is not on the particular faults or weaknesses that we have. They're temporary. What is the most important thing about a human being is not these characteristics, but that is of the power to choose and think and act and be him or herself as a thinker, as a soul, with power and responsibility. Three, when he is impeded at all, or hindered, he blames himself. If a man praises him, he ridicules the praiser to himself. If a man censures him, he makes no defense. In other words, he takes full responsibility. Karma is a doctrine of responsibility. If he's at fault, he owns it. If a man praises him, flatters him, he does not outwardly criticize, but within inwardly he reminds himself that this person really doesn't know of what he speaks. I've made faults, I've made mistakes. If I'm here where I'm now, it's because of what I've been able to accomplish. If a man censors him, he makes no defense. If it's true, he listens. If it's not true, he ignores it. He removes all desire from himself, and he transfers aversions to those things, only of the things within our power which are contrary to our nature. He removes all desire from himself, and he only wants to avoid those things which he can avoid, which are contrary to his nature as a spiritual being, as a thinker, as a soul. He employs a moderate movement towards everything, the same idea. He is moderate in his actions, just like we see that repeated in the Bhagavad Gita and the teachings of Buddha. Whether he is considered foolish or ignorant by others, he cares not. He's only his own final authority and judge. His principal teaching is that you choose how to interpret and think about events that happen to you. Negative feelings are completely your choice and in the realm of pliable thought. He also teaches not to envy or to be jealous of another human being, since you have not paid the price that that other human being has in the form of time, effort, work, flattery, and so on. For things that a man can achieve which you cannot, you will possess things that he does not have. So, aside from it being instructive, the idea that this timeless wisdom has found its expression in many different civilizations, in many different ways, according to the people it came to, it also shows us that part of understanding a theosophical principle such as karma or the law of cause and effect is being able to make it powerful in one's life, to make it practical. And we think there is, aside from devotional books, there is no other finer example of how to make these ideas practical, especially from the Western literature point of view, than we can find in the writings of the Stoic philosophers, Epictetus, and of course, Marcus Aurelius. One an emperor, the other a slave. It's interesting. So there are many, like we said, there are many other quotes that we were given and references to other historical personages. We just might finish, though, with a few quotes from the Stoics, particularly Aurelius, which give us that idea that this whole philosophy is based on an understanding of karma as a law of harmony, of cause and effect, a law of nature of which we are subject to, but which we can act in accordance with as well. To love only what happens, what was destined, there is no greater harmony. The first step, don't be anxious. Nature controls it all. A man, when he has done a good act, does not call out for others to come and see, but he goes on to another act, as a vine goes on to produce again the grapes in their season. And so we can say from these few examples we've given, the simple expression that was used, not very high metaphysical teachings, not laced with a lot of theological dogma, but straight to the point wisdom directed to the mind, directed to the reasonable part of our nature, and encouraging us to be soul beings. And we know they understood it as soul because one of the principal quotes from the Stoics is the soul or the mind becomes dyed with the color of its thoughts. So we welcome you to offer any questions or comments on what you've heard about these teachings of Epictetus and the Stoics. Also, but what, any other questions you might have on how we might take these teachings, these principles of karma and reincarnation, and apply them practically in our everyday life. Yes?
Well, in comparing what we heard with one's own experiences, we think about it, and we recall some other words. On Christ the solid rock I stand, all other ground is sinking sand. Now, as far as the term from Christ, we can pass around that, but on a solid rock I stand, all other ground is sinking sand. So I have to think about that.
There was a time when Epictetus was enslaved and he was in prison. And he wrote about the measure of a man. And those words became the title of a very popular novel in the 20th century, The Measure of a Man. And the great plot of it is this, this human being who, through various circumstances, found himself in prison, and while in prison came across the teachings of Epictetus and a certain saying on the measure of a man. And it turned him around, and from that point he eventually got his freedom and remade his whole life. And the book goes on to express what he did and help others. But the essence of was that the measure of a man is not the environment, is not the outward circumstances. They're all changing. And there's a statement here about the changes that occurs in life. Everything is going through change. So, should we be surprised that our lives are not changing all the time, like the shifting sand? So what is the measure? What is the rock upon which we are to stand? And it is ourselves as thinkers, that nothing else matters. And it was this constant effort of the Stoics to direct the attention of the person, whether they were a slave or an emperor, rich or poor, away from the outer part to the inner world, the rock within upon which they can stand, the spiritual nature. Now, this was not a so-called spiritual or directly religious philosophy, so it didn't refer to terms like Buddha or Krishna or Christ. But if we understand that those terms signify the spiritual divine essence in a human being that is unchanging and universal, it is the rock. It is the source of power on which every human being can stand. And what makes us aware of that permanence, that power, is a faculty that the human being has that no other kingdom of nature below the human being has, and that is the faculty of self-conscious awareness, self-analyzing reflection, what we call the mind, the thinker. So our ability to think and reflect on our own spiritual unchanging nature is the rock. And what we find there in our nature is the true measure of our worth as a being, not the outer changing world. Yes.
Listening to this, we really hear echoes of Buddhism. You know, it's very prominent, especially the when Buddha talks about suffering and the cause of suffering. Very stoic.
Mm-hmm. So what does the Buddha say? Of course, Buddha taught at a time prior to the Stoics. But it was based on four truths: that life is full of suffering. Whether you're low or high, or emperor or slave, you're going to face some degree of suffering, whether it's from natural causes like old age or illness or incapacity. There's also another kind of suffering. The great cause of suffering is our desires, because we desire what is constantly changing. And the Stoics taught the same thing. Everything's changing. You've got to abandon all desires for that. Don't hold on to that. But abandon the attachment to those which is contrary to your nature. Hold on to that which is like your spiritual nature. So it's once again. And so how did the Buddha teach to eliminate desires, the cause of suffering? Well, eliminate desire, just as the Stoics said, reject desire. But replace it with an eightfold path, a practical path of living, right effort, right thinking, right occupation, right devotion. In other words, an instructional manual or guide at hand, a sword, if you will, to help us in the problems of life. And by living this eightfold path of harmony and balance, this middle path, which doesn't seek extremes but is moderate, we eventually learn to control the desires. And as you're saying, that is, we see that later reflected in the teachings of the Stoics. And it is not surprising, because the Buddhists, the monks, the disciples of the Buddha, after they left India and went into Northern Asia, they also went out to other areas, into the Mediterranean basin, and not only influenced the Essenes, but also had influence in Asia Minor, where Stoicism had its original foundation, and later into Greece and into Rome. So we see there was a widespread. And just as Buddhism is embraced in our modern times by psychologists as having very practical advice, so is the teachings of the Stoics. The words are changed, the sayings are changed, but the underlying principles are the same. Yes?
Well, it would seem by logical extension that if Stoicism is correct, we're responsible for our own actions and development. One life runs out, there's not enough duration to take care of all that, is there? So by logical extension, his teachings support reincarnation.
His teachings support reincarnation, and the student who prepared this talk did mention that they had come across some statements that Epictetus also directly talked about reincarnation, and he was reputed to have had a school for his own disciples in which he might have taught them the mysteries of that. But the student themselves could not find any proof or evidence of that other than mention of it. So we could not say as to what beliefs directly Epictetus had about that. But from our own understanding of what they thought this law of nature was, whether we look at it from a one-life perspective, as most of the people who Epictetus was dealing with at time, or whether we look at it from a perspective of many lives, one has to begin to, in order to gain a sense of responsibility, is to realize that they set up causes and reap the results of them. So sometimes the question comes up, well, how do I talk about theosophy with other people? I mean, they're not familiar with reincarnation and karma. How do I talk to my family and my friends without having to use the word karma? because they may come from a religion or a tradition or may have no understanding of that, although it's kind of hard to think that these days because everybody seems to know the idea of karma. This was not true 100 years ago. But now it's pretty well known. So how do you introduce the concepts or the theosophical teachings about karma? And one of the ways is to do it the way Epictetus does. And to say, well, look, if you want to understand karma or a cause and effect, you have to realize that the law doesn't stop when you put your hand into a fire and it's burned, or you swing a door and it comes back onto you. It also applies to the way you think. You think and you feel a certain way, and it has a reaction to you. It either enslaves you or it frees you. And so step by step, you expand this idea of the law of cause and effect as being a natural law. And so it is just one more step to recognize the permanence of the soul, of our spiritual nature, to realize that death, which only has to do with the physical, it's a change of the physical, and the physical is changing all the time, that death does not occur to the soul or spirit. And so the law continues to operate there, and those causes that soul, that individual thinker, set up in one life, whether in harmony or not in harmony, come back to that source and have their effect. There is no karma, go back to the original statement, there is no karma unless there is a being to make it and feel its effects. Yes?
Well, it seems though that these ideas over time become diluted, that is, weakened, and others take those ideas and sort of dilute them and still attract others.
There is a dilution of ideas. Well, we certainly can forget a teaching. Sometimes we read something or even have a dream or an experience, and unless we constantly repeat it, write it down or read it again, we forget. It becomes diluted in our memory. But you're speaking here of a different kind of dilution, other than that caused by time, and that has to do with the nature of the human being, the human mind itself, which takes ideas and becomes creative with them. And that when that mind has an idea and it's involved with its passions and desires and senses, very often that original idea, which seems so firm, now begins to be affected or diluted by the influences of our senses and our experiences and our desires. We even have a term, we say we rationalize, or we change our ideas, or we dilute them because of the influence of our desires and senses. So we do the same thing with children. We tell them about the tooth fairy. We heard this recently. And mother admitted to her child that the tooth fairy didn't always deliver. And later on was confronted by the child, well, why did you tell me about the tooth fairy if it was you all the time? And she said, well, it was the truth that you had. It was the truth at the time that I had to tell you. So very often we do that as human beings. We want to make an impression on a young mind or mind that may not be able to comprehend certain consequences. And so we tell a half-truth or a veiled truth or a diluted truth, something that can be understood. The only thing is that gets carried down that legend or that story gets carried down, and sometimes it becomes a truth in itself because it's repeated so often. But we have the same idea with fairy tales, and it's a way of remembering things. There are the fairy tales or the myths or the legends dilute the truth. It's not the pure truth, it's not the whole truth, but it's a way of carrying the truth in its certain degrees so that it can be remembered and used by the masses, by most people. Even Jesus says, to his disciples, to you I give the mysteries of heaven, and for the masses, the fables, the stories, because they're truth, but they're diluted down into packages which can be immediately used. And that's what the Stoics did. They took grand philosophical truths and they distilled them down, they diluted them down into truths which were true in their own right, but were not the complete ultimate truth. I mean, one had to be really interested in the philosophy and the science to go into it more. And that was the few, but most people just needed some practical advice on how to live their lives. And that suited them just fine. So, any other? Yes?
We were just thinking, and that's why the word practical can be so important. If you just say, well, is this really practical? Mm-hmm. But sometimes in the young people, they don't think to ask that. They just go ahead with it. But if you would stop and think to ask yourself, it would be the same thing. Is this necessary?
Yes.
Think on your feet.
Yes. What do you do as an adult when you're anxious? When you're confronted with adversity? What practical things do you do? Do you raid the refrigerator? Do you read a book? Do you go out and exercise? Do you find a friend? Do you call your mother? Do you want to be hugged? What is it that you do as an adult? Do you study theosophy? You try to get a person. What is it that you do as an adult that helps you, that practically helps you deal with stressors? Yes.
I was one of those mindless refrigerator raiders. But practically, I substituted the habit of pausing and sitting down to ponder and then writing it. Just writing all about it. And gradually what starts to happen is theosophy starts bubbling through in that venting. And then you can shred those pages or burn those pages, it's gone, you can let go.
So we were at a elementary school yesterday, and it was obviously not the day of the week, but it was a young classroom. And the children in this classroom would have been around 4 to 5 years old. And one of the activities of the teacher was to have the children express themselves, what did they do when they get anxious? And to draw what they did in anxious. And we took a picture of it, this bullet board, because all the responses of the children, what they do when they're 3 or 4 years old, when they're very anxious and scared, is the same thing we do as adults. So one said, I'd like to go read a book. And the other said, I'd like to go get a hug from my mommy. And another said, I'd like to go get something from the refrigerator and eat. I want a lollipop. These things start to sound familiar. In other words, we develop habits from very early age that we practically use to deal with the problems of life. So we have certain ideas. So this is where the cognitive behavioral therapists come in. They try to have us look at our habits and what we jump to and begin to substitute them with other things that could be better off. But what we learn is that wherever we are now, whatever habits we have now, if they're not constructive or healthy, we can change them by substituting a better practical approach. And one is to get knowledge, to learn how, like that little child said, I go read a book. I like to read a book, that comforts me. Well, maybe we need to read something, or maybe we need to improve a relationship. All these things are practical ways in which we can deal with life. And karma, reincarnation, one does not have to be a scholar or a book reader or attend a lot of lectures to understand the simple principles of it, which are understandable to a child, to make it, give it practical application in one's life about how to deal with those kinds of difficulties that we all face throughout our lives. And so in the whole philosophy of theosophy, and there's much covering many aspects of life, the two most important doctrines for us, especially in the West, to reinvigorate, to reemploy, because it's lost to us. We used to have it at an earlier time in our civilization, but it's become muted, diluted through time, are these two doctrines of reincarnation and karma. And as said, these are words which today are very popular, maybe not completely understood, but very popular. Most people would understand what they meant. But at the time, theosophy was re-exposed to the Western world in the late 1800s, very few people in the West had even heard of those words. So we've come a long way in that regard. Yes?
Just as a note, I'm not sure if I heard correctly. How old was that Epictetus when he died?
How old? Okay, well, let's see. He was so he was born 55 C afterward, and he died. So he must have been 135. So it was in his 80s? 80s?
Okay.
Yeah. Was your point?
Well, I was just... I thought I heard something differently. I thought he lived to a very old age.
Well, Well, 80s was kind of old. It was a long time at those. And for a long time, he was in exile. So I have all that information. Okay. He, along with many other philosophers, was banished from Rome during the reign of Domitian, eventually settled in Nicopolis, where he attracted many students. The Emperor Hadrian numbered among his students, and he did not bother with a rigorous system of thought, wisely believing that overly complex systems eventually became dead mechanisms. And so, and so it's his work is recognized as one of the foundational works of the Western literature. Yes?
Well, certainly, listening to the story, the great help is that in our present situation, there's so many of those ideas, as we have stated, have been dressed up, colored over. But here, we learn about the source of so many things.
The source?
The source. Where did they come from?
Where did they come from?
And when that happens, oh boy, you're going to start getting an interest in sons and nieces.
Yes. And that's one of the important aspects of this kind of education, is to go to the sources themselves, the original teachings as we have them. And we see that, of course, many of the great reformers and sages in the world did not write things down by themselves, and they were written down by their students. And so we have to go to those, and if we put them side by side and take the time to compare them, we see the repetition of many themes, many kernels of truth. So next week we enter a new month and a new umbrella topic, cycles and cyclic law. Next Sunday's talk will be on cyclic influences on humanity and individuals. And this coming Wednesday we will continue our study in the ocean theosophy on the principles of the human being. Our meeting is adjourned.